Welcome to Holden Village in the Creekside Room. Today's speaker is Bruce Eklund, and he will be doing a session entitled Valuing Our Children in a Consumer Society. So, let's listen in on Bruce.
Those of you who haven't been in a session with me before, just a little bit of background as to who I am. I'm a supervisor at the Snohomish County Juvenile Court in Everett, Washington, just the other side of the mountains. We're in it's the third largest county in Washington, a county of about 600,000, and we have experienced significant growth in the last 10, 12 years, so that we are now experiencing what you would call urban problems as opposed to suburban or rural problems that we had previously. So this session is the final session in 2 weeks that I've been giving on issues around valuing our children. We've kind of weaved around through affirming the hard work of parenting and talking about some abuse issues, physical abuse, talked a lot about spanking, talked about sexual abuse and television, the effect of television on children. So this is also a part of it that I have never taught before. So this is something that we're all creating together in terms of the issues. We all live in the same consumer society. We all live in, we all have children or are around children within this society. And so what I want to do with you with this is I have some material to help that seems helpful to kind of ways that we can think about this. And I intend this to be lots of dialogue and lots of questions and so what I hope to be able to do is to identify what those key areas are where the concept of valuing children, which is, in my mind anyway, the most critical parenting that we do, how that sets against then the stream within our culture of consumerism. My understanding, at least what I'm saying when I say a consumer society, it really means a production and consumer society, that we live within a society that focuses our work and oftentimes our value in what we can accomplish within our culture is often related to what we produce. And then on the other side of it is we earn the money as in our production kind of jobs, and then we flip it over and we become the consumers, and our expectation then, or the cultural expectation, is we take this money that we get from producing these things and we buy these things and other things. And so there's a whole system. Our economic system is dependent upon us both as producers as well as consumers. It presents, in my mind, some interesting, just some interesting dilemmas for us as Christians and for us as people who view the world as a place that needs to be sustained and nourished. It sets apart some values that I certainly struggle with having my children have, and yet it's kind of the mainstream of that consumer society. I wrote down some things. These are just things that I have been thinking about, and I kind of lay them out for discussion. They're not experts. They're just my ideas. Kind of some verses, value of work, which is the productive part of us, versus what I would call the implicit value of people, or in a sense that's unproductive, that you don't have to be productive to have value. And that's something that is somewhat at odds. In a sense, this is the gospel here. This is the gospel message telling us that we don't have to do anything. That's the grace. That who we are as the beings that we are created have value. Possessing, and that's a big term, and it means lots and lots of things, but mostly it means collecting and having things. So possessing, in the sense that at least I'm thinking of it, and there may be a broader sense, has to do with collecting things, with having things that we call our own, and it can include land. It's a mindset, essentially, of having things that are ours, versus observing, imagining, creating, playing, making, borrowing, sharing, a more of a sense of not owning things, but seeing them in the context of there are things out there, there are other ways of obtaining those things other than possessing them. The buying versus doing continuum, which is somewhat related up here. The concept, for me anyway, that's an idea where if you want something, that our mindset within our culture is to go buy it rather than to make it. And this particularly is a part that applies to kids. If they want a truck, we go down to the toy store and look for a truck for them to pick out and buy. That's a different message that we're teaching our children than if we say, okay, well, let's go into the garage. Here's some things we can use for wheels, and this is something we can use as an axle, and this is how it would fit together. Now, what do we need to do in order to make sure that those wheels can spin? And then putting the bed on it and painting it and doing all that kind of thing. The relationship that we have in the doing of things is, in my mind anyway, exponentially bigger than the relate. We have relationship here, and you can create relationship through going out and having a time of going out and buying. But it's a different concept in terms of what that relationship is. And then also the whole perspective that this, the productive consumer society and the affluence with which America is gifted is creating this world of haves and have-nots. Not only within our culture, it creates this polarization. But even more so, you can see that on a more global scale. Let me just read a couple of things for you that I ran across that really, really caught my eye. One of them on the concept of work, actually a couple of sections. This is on a book called Good Work by E.F. Schumacher. Schumacher is the one that wrote the book Small is Beautiful and is a thorn in the flesh of big business. And he writes, I think, powerfully as a critic and a prophet within our time. He's talking, this comes in a place where he's talking about the system that we create, which stunts personality and corrupts human relations, by permitting the use of man by man as an instrument of pecuniary gain. And the system he refers to is the modern industrial society, which in a sense is that production consumption society that I was referring to. In what way does it stunt personality? I should say mainly by making most forms of work, both manual and white-collared, utterly uninteresting and meaningless. Mechanical, artificial, divorced from nature, utilizing only the smallest part of our potential capabilities, it sentences the great majority of us to spending our working lives in a way which contains no worthy challenge, no stimulus to self-perfection, no chance of development, and no element of beauty, truth, or goodness. Pretty harsh words. The basic aim of modern industrialism is not to make work satisfying, but to raise productivity. Its proudest achievement is labor saving, whereby labor is stamped with the mark of undesirability. So that here we get some of that tension, as I see it, between what, when we live in this kind of society, work, which is what we're trying to get our kids to do their chores, and yet the overall culture of work within our land is something that the concept of productivity is trying to reduce, so it becomes stamped as undesirable. What is undesirable cannot confer dignity. So the working life of a laborer is a life without dignity. The result, not surprisingly, is a spirit of sullen irresponsibility which refuses to be mollified by higher wage awards, but is often only stimulated by them. And another place where he kind of talks more about reform, how we reform the system. And let's see, where should I start it here? I shall be asked to declare what any one of us can do in this very difficult situation. What did Christians do during the breakdown of the Roman Empire? And he's talking here previously about the role then of individuals within this society where we believe differently than what the root philosophy or the root basis of the industrial society is. And so looking then back at the fall of the Roman Empire, what did the Christians do during the breakdown of the Roman Empire? They did not run away, but went to work cheerfully among the apparent doom. The degeneration of the industrial system, that is, its ever-intensified idolatry of getting rich quickly, offers everywhere ample opportunities for bringing light into dark places. Everywhere, the values of freedom, responsibility, and human dignity have to be openly affirmed. Even where a neglect of these values, okay, would appear to allow the big industrial machine to run more smoothly or more efficiently. So the neglect, by neglecting the values of freedom, responsibility, and human dignity, by neglecting those values, it's a double negative, and so it's hard to catch, but by neglecting those, that's what helps the machinery of the industrial society run smoothly. It's when you pay attention to those that you give offense. And he says further, it may not be possible to do this without causing offense. The relationship for me, anyway, in terms of raising children, is raising them with that sense of value, with a sense of self-esteem, and with a sense of dignity. And yet we live within a culture where the very essence of that tends to shift the other way. Those aren't necessarily skills that are going to help them in the workplace. What do you feel about that as a premise? Does that make sense to you?
You're saying high self-esteem wouldn't help them in the workplace?
That high self-esteem does not help them in the workplace, in an industrial society. There are some jobs where high self-esteem would be very important, but there's a majority of the jobs within our culture do not require high self-esteem to be able to do. In fact, high self-esteem can get in the way of actually doing them.
You're talking about labor-type, factory-type work?
That would be included, but I think there's many white-collar jobs, management kinds of jobs, where you're caught in this system that is a preset system, and you're not expected to think, you're just expected to perform. That if you question or you can be set apart by having a strong sense of justice, which self-esteem tends to bring.
I guess I think it's pretty complicated, but even to succeed in a lot of professions that are valued, you know, in our culture, I think we are trained to give up a lot of the wholeness of life in order to do that. I don't know how to verbalize that, but I guess that well, the first stuff you talked about, I read, and I can't remember which one, about our jobs often not, and I think, I mean, I like my job, sort of, but it's very narrow, you know, I do child abuse cases, boom, and, you know, if I were really going to value myself and choose a life that was whole, I would choose to have a lot more free time to try to develop creative interests or whatever, rather than our culture affirms and rewards, you know, a track life of, you know, succeeding on whatever it is.
I think that the separation of work from the rest of life is really an important concept, because, I mean, you're speaking about wholeness, mm-hmm. but this idea that there is this you over here and then there's this other you over here causes all kinds of problems. And also for kids. I mean, I hear kids talk about, well, this is what I do to learn it, but this is what I do to get a grade. And they're two very different, you know, two very different things, which is a form of this. This is who I really am in terms of living out a vocation, but this is what I do for my paycheck or for my, you know, my productive work. So I think that separation, I think in management, I teach some in public administration and also have been doing some work in leadership studies recently. And this old paradigm about, you know, being a pig in a machine and so on is really everywhere under challenge. So I think a lot of what you're saying is true about people being sort of treated like cogs in organizations. But I also see a lot of hopefulness about that really being challenged. And a lot of even what you would consider commercial companies experimenting with much more freedom for workers and so on.
I appreciate I guess the two questions come up for me in what you said. One is, in thinking through, you know, is there a way as parents that we can raise our children and as healthy kids and to be able to function in that kind of divided kingdom? Okay, that's one question. The other is that I think I've had some experience or talked with some people who have had some experiences where business touts teamwork, that we're a family, that kind of thing, but when the going gets tough, you know, it's the profit that drives ultimately the personnel policies. It's not the relationship. And so I'm somewhat skeptical of situations that tout that until and after they've gone through a tough period and have held on to their employees and haven't laid employees off. Because if they're touting the language of family, touting the language of let's, we're a team here, management and labor or whatever your jobs are, but they don't perform that when the going gets tough and they don't maintain and value that relationship, then I think it's a bunch of bunk. I think it's another form of manipulating. They're just using different words. So those are. But what about raising our kids in terms of knowing the kind of society that they come in, or that they're going to be growing up in? At least our perception. The best we can do as parents or grandparents is understanding what this world is going to be, kind of projecting ahead. What skills do our kids really need to be able to succeed in that world? And do we want, are those skills that we want to teach them? Do we want them to succeed in the world that, you know?
Well, and what is succeed?
Good question. Yeah. What is succeed? And that kind of goes back with what is possessing or what, I mean, how do you value that? You know, it gets up here. What do we mean by valuing our children? And it's kind of like if people have lots of things, are they happy? You know, there's a myth that I see in our culture that somehow that's a myth that makes people happy. And where does that myth get perpetuated?
Commercialism on TV.
Right, certainly advertising is a strong statement there. Tom, you can say something?
Yeah, I guess I don't know how to process this exactly because we're in the midst of this at Weta High School with the school-to-work concept of getting companies to come in and make relationships and do some mentoring, some job shadowing, and working with kids. We're well aware that you don't send kids out into society right now where they push a button and the thing drops down and they put a pin in and they go on. This whole industrial thing back 20 years, 30 years ago, isn't there for them to go to work. Even at Boeing, hitting the rivet gun, well, the machine does it. Now, if you've been to Boeing, I don't know if you've seen where they line it up, the machine comes down, rivets the whole wing, you know, and you don't have the rivet gun anymore. So they have to be communicators, for one, and I guess I know an executive at Boeing that goes to our church, and he's telling me, as I teach my communication class at high school, that's one of the things. These people have to be communicators. They have to be able to get along with other people. Mm-hmm. Now, I know they talk the word teamwork, but still, it is a teamwork society. It isn't an individualist society that's out there. And there's a lot of factors that get into the kids going out into the work world. Some of the things they're running into are such as the jobs they try to get, they won't give them 40 hours. They'll give them 30 hours or whatever. They're being manipulated away from benefits. Companies are playing games all over the place with our younger generation, frustrating them all over the place. And so I guess this value of work and the implicit value of people, you've got some pretty good things there. Our kids, I guess, have, you know, they feel kind of done in, I think, by what you're talking about. Things look good until it starts going down, and there's some hard facts. When there isn't money there, people have to go. But they have to be good communicators. They have to be able to present themselves. They have more than a little bit of education coming out of high school. And that's what we're trying to do right now. Is in fact, a gal at our school's been given a $30,000 grant by the federal government to work on this school-to-work programs and getting kids aware of what's required by business. What are you going to be required? What's the value of what you're being learned? What you're learning in the classroom? How can you apply it? Okay, then as teachers, we're being asked to be more realistic about what we're teaching. And then she's asking me why I'm teaching Shakespeare. you know, it's a complicated.
That question is a key, because implicit here for me anyway is the arts, and that there's not productive value. People don't. I mean, a few people do. Few people rise to the top of the musical field and are actually able to make an income from it. But most people experience music, experience art, you know, not only experience it, but create it and do it as a, you know, for the implicit value that it gives. And that's one of the things, I think, that we're losing with the cultural kind of push. And one of the things I think is part of valuing our children, at least for me, is assisting them in experiencing that wholeness of life. Because when you don't experience that, when you don't have an opportunity to get excited about some of Shakespeare, or you know, read some of Elizabeth Browning Barrett's poems, or Barrett Browning's poems, you lose. There's an element of the spiritual part of us that connects with those things that we lose. So. But they're not productive, and so the grants, you're not going to likely get grants other than through National Endowment for the Arts. You might get something.
Which are
going to
be canceled.
Which right now, politically, is in real serious trouble.
We've had a superintendent in the past now that has not supported the arts. Mm-hmm. And I guess, as I've talked to people, I still ask them, when you go back to look at the Romans or the Greeks, what do we see is left? Do we see their money changing and all their businesses and so forth, or what do we see? We see the arts that are left over from a society. All these cultures, that's what we're really looking at in a great deal, what was left over, and what are we kind of working back towards?
We're creating have and have-nots among the children along those dimensions.
That's right.
because I'm in now a very mediocre school district where there are no arts for most of the kids to speak of. And everything that my children have had along those lines, I have purchased for them on the side, you know, music lessons and concerts. And so the kind of student, say at the high school level, who knows he or she has to go out and get a job right away, has got to have this package that you're very conscientiously trying to put together for them, because that's what, but at the same time, they're among the have-nots already, because that whole side of their development is being pushed out for the vocational training. So it's either or.
And it's not
only the
athletes
who get both, right? Yeah. Who can prolong their education and sort of be a kid and express and all these things in elementary and secondary, because they know that college is coming and there will be time for the vocational later.
But see, there's a cry of a group of people within our district, parents, that are pushing down that either we have International Baccalaureate, if you know what that is, or EP programs, advanced placement programs, for a group of kids.
Their kids. That's all.
And they're the noisy ones. They're there. They're at the school board. They're pushing. And therefore, we will have those programs. But this middle group, or the arts, that isn't so important. They want to make sure that their kids...
Okay, and what is their drive? What is their ultimate goal for their children then?
East Coast College
is so that they can earn a lot of money, so that they can probably, so that they can have lots of things. I don't know.
I'm not sure.
Yeah. Elmer, you had
what's the expectation that the school is going to do all that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is the consumer society.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
We are it.
Right.
We expect them to do all that. When I grew up, nobody had got that in school. We never got that in school. Mm-hmm. That had to come from the family. It come from the parents. Mm-hmm. Republicans may not have all dumb ideas. I don't know. I'm a Democrat.
You know, it's an interesting.
I don't think work is doing that to us. I think we're doing that. I've got kids who are working 70 and 80 hours. My children, while their children are not having their care, they're choosing to do that. Somehow, I or everybody else taught them that they ought to get all these things so they can take a trip, so they can come to Holden, so they can send kids to Harvard, all the other stuff. I don't think their jobs are doing it. I think my kids are doing it. I bear responsibility partially for my kids.
So that's where then, as far as I see, is how do we respond? Mm-hmm. In a sense, it's like swimming upstream, because the values of our culture are exactly what you're saying there, Elmer, I believe, is that there is that expectation, there is the expectation, the desire within the schools to provide all these things, and yet somehow there's a devaluing of our children in the midst of that. That's the key point that I think is hard to arrive at, but that is there, and we need to pay attention to. In other words, kind of what you were saying, what is success? And what is wholeness and what is health in our children? And is it possible? This is the dilemma that I see. Is it possible for our children to be healthy and whole and be successful as the world sees it, as our industrial society sees it?
I just rebel against that idea, because if we buy into that, I firmly believe our world will not survive us. We cannot view success like that. I just don't think we can. I think we have to get to the point where we want to simplify our lives and use less stuff. We can't.
Right.
We can't use all the stuff we are using.
Right. Well, I think that's what I'm saying. I'm not quite sure. The concept of success, when I say success, I mean what the industrial society, what our consumer production society calls success, which is that possession, having things, using things, okay? And that we have the right to do that because we have the money to do that. And that's the concept of success, is tied to money there. And I think as families, I'm not sure that it's possible to raise what I perceive as whole, healthy children and have them be able to be a success as the world sees it. That's what I meant.
Right.
That's what I was trying to say.
Yeah, I think
you're right. So, dilemma going, too, where our kids are looking at us, and at 1966, we bought a home right away when we were married for $19,000, I think it was. But, you know, the salaries and so forth, it isn't there anymore for those kids. That whole thing that we went through, maybe the golden age, I don't know if that was the golden age, or consumer age at least, that's what it was. They're going to have to live in a different world, and I don't know if we're really heading them off in the right direction there. There's, again, the value of people.
That's a tough question.
There's a lot of things that are happening. Decline of unions, uh-huh. This whole thing of health care, of all these things that seem to be going away.
It's like, where's the new paradigm shift going to come in?
Mm-hmm. I got two suggestions for aging people. Here I am.
Yeah.
Here we are.
Stop your grandparents from buying gifts for your kids. Hmm. Tell them to stop. I won't buy gifts for my grandchildren. I won't do it. They got too much junk already. They got more stuff than they have. And I'm the good one. My mother did that all the time. Brought my kids stuff when we told her not to. She always did. I refuse to do it. I'm spending money on them. September, I'm taking the grandchildren down to the Outer Banks of North Carolina. We're going to go on a train. We're going to visit some stuff. We're going to do some things that are crazy and stuff like that. But I'm not going to buy them gifts anymore. Secondly, treat retired grandparents as people with implicit value and stop asking us, what are you doing? What I do is I'm retired. That's my life. My retired.
Could you be just taking that question wrong? could you be defensive there and taking that question wrong?
No, I love what I am doing.
Well, then,
but that is not my existence.
If somebody asks you what you're doing, do you take that as meaning that you have to be productive to feel that the person is thinking, meaning that right. You take that as that kind of a question?
Yeah, exactly. Uh-huh. Because then they say, oh. you have to take the whole conversation where you can hear it.
Something. You can't sleep all day. I was interested in knowing what you do.
Sleeping is part of my retirement.
I'd like to regain control of this session.
But that reminds me of in the women's movement when you learn not to ask the question, do you work?
Right.
Do you remember that?
Yeah.
Do you work?
Mm-hmm. Do you work?
Yes.
But then that all immediately had to be changed to do you work outside the home?
Yeah, right? Sure.
Or how do you spend your time?
Yes. You know, which is the same kind of, all this baggage being put on these questions.
But people are just asking.
Sometimes
they're
just
trying to think of some way to have a conversation.
Let me build on Elmer's first point. Because I'm prepared to deal with that one. In a book called Taking Charge of Our Lives, Living Responsibly in the World, it's put out by the American Friends Service Committee in San Francisco. They have a section on what they call gifting, a perversion of giving. And it relates, and there's a couple of stories in there I want to share with you. In few areas, in the invented need impact of advertising, and the compulsive consumption it can promote, more evident than in the transformation of giving into gifting. Gifting activity peaks during Christmas, Hanukkah, winter solstice, hereafter referred to as Xmas, in the United States. Many of us run around for a month or so worrying and feeling guilty if we cannot find exactly the right things to buy for one another. Often we measure our worth by the extent of our involvement in Xmas gifting. The main reason for the stress on Xmas gifting is profit. Many department stores and other retail outlets, as well as toy manufacturers and other industries, can survive without profits during the rest of the year if they come out far enough ahead in December. Their message to us is that the best way to show our love and appreciation for one another is to buy something. Giving has been an important part of almost all human cultures. Giving and sharing have been the basis of the economic system of some traditional societies. In others, festivals in which gifts are given or goods are distributed were a means of ensuring the survival of the community as a whole and compensating, ensuring the survival of the community as a whole and compensating for inequalities in strength and skill. Among the Sioux Indians, high status was partly based on the ability and desire to provide for the old and helpless. During a hunt, and this is a quote now, a story, the council sent for certain young men who were being noticed by the people. And to these the chief said, "Good young men, my relatives, your work I know is good. What you do is good always. So today you will feed the helpless and the old and feeble. Maybe there is an old woman or an old man who has no son. Or there may be a woman who has little children but no man. You will know these and hunt only for them. Today you belong to the needy." This made the young men very proud, for it was a great honor. Contrast a typical gift giving in consumerist America. Quote, "The company gave me a fine Christmas bonus for staying with them another year, and together with our credit cards, we really felt flush. We bought a lot of stuff. On Christmas Eve, there were well-chosen gifts for everyone, a roaring fire, eggnog, carols, family, and our tree centered on a pile of presents. January 28th, we got a bill from MasterCharge, and the next day from the Emporium, and Pennies and Ward's. Even Mobile got into the act. Please remit the amount shown in the box above. Your minimum payment is $10. The Christmas spirit was gone, and the bills were there to pay, and I was wondering what was happening to us that we had to buy Christmas." One other. In our society, as among the Sioux, a holiday can be an occasion for giving material gifts where they are needed and welcome. Humans also need more than bare material necessities, and from time to time we may indeed think of or see the perfect gift for a friend or relative that we cannot create with our own talents and skills. If we can afford it, even at considerable personal sacrifice, the joy that it may give is well worth the money. But giving in this way comes from different impulse than does advertising-inspired giving or giving to make a good impression. So I think that's part of, at least for me, that sense of buying versus doing that we get into, that's rooted in the consumerism within our culture, that our economic structure is dependent upon us buying. It's not something that, according to our economic structure, that we have choice about. You know, we're a free society, and yet to a certain extent we're roped in to the mores and the culture, and we have to break out of it. And I think that the part of it is our kids are in it maybe even more than we are.
Targeted.
Our kids are targeted more, advertising targets them. I was going to write up here Saturday morning cartoons, especially for young children. And one of the things I shared in one of the other sessions was the automatic negative relationship that advertising creates in parenting, because it inflicts our children with this need. So they believe what they're told on television, that they need this thing that's being advertised. They need a Power Rangers t-shirt, okay? So they go to parents and say, "I need this," okay? And it sets up the dynamic then where the parent more often than not has to say no. And so it, unless that there's greater relationship for that, if that's the extent of the information, it's a constant battering back and forth of negatives. But if the parents can take charge of that and to begin to talk with the child, to use that as a springboard, again, to talk with the child, to help the child understand the nature of advertising, to understand what's going on there. But it takes a broader relationship of the parent to the child to do that. So, any comments on the gifting? Is that a helpful... I like the fact that they chose a different word, that we can call it gifting as opposed to giving. Mm-hmm. That was helpful to me.
I think that's real meaningful, and I wish somebody would have told me to tell my parents not to give stuff to my kids, because I watched what you're describing, very well-meaning. But, you know, I still have my favorite doll, and it's sitting on my dresser. My daughter doesn't know which doll's her favorite doll, and she's got a million dolls, and, you know, they're in the attic. And it's all well-meaning, but there's just too much stuff available to... we're not being taught to say less is better. It is qualitatively better. It's
yeah. John.
Interestingly, I first heard the word gifted used in, you know, by religious people.
Uh-huh.
And I don't like the word at all. But I mean, I like it. I like the way it's used in your context. But it's religious people that talk about being gifted, gifted uh-huh. by God.
Oh.
Being,
uh-huh.
And this money was gifted to us.
Uh-huh.
They're the ones that thought that word up, I think.
Huh. Yeah, that's interesting. I hadn't thought of it in that context, but that's I think I have heard it in that way.
Another spin on this, by with his kids getting a lot of stuff, I guess we're seeing also is kids with plastic, right. The credit card, not able to handle it, not being aware of, you know, the consequence. It seems to run true a great deal. A family where you hear kids taking the card, what is he done?
Yeah.
Or is she done? They don't seem to have value. You know, it's plastic, it's magic, there's no problem.
I think that there's kind of looking at flipping maybe a little bit to using that as a springboard into maybe some of the solution issues in terms of how, as parents, what are some of the things that we can do to help our kids deal with this. They're going to live in a consumer society. There's no question about that. They're also going to be living in a society that's going to be much higher technical level, much more computer focused, much more email, even more the networking, online America. I mean, it's just exploding. So that's their world is going to be more closely related to that. You know, virtual reality kinds of things are gonna come strongly. I think that's gonna replace television. I think issues in terms of the personalness. It's like everybody having their own television set, and their ability. Then I think commercially, that's what's gonna become. We're gonna be faced with out of the virtual reality piece. But anyway, the issue, as I see it, and drawing from. A book that I read for a second time and has been out for quite a while, and I just found out has set some kind of record on the nonfiction bestseller mm-hmm. list for 18 years or something like that, he's got a lot of good stuff to tell us in there, and I broke out some stuff on discipline, which I think is the key, and it's a key word that we use a lot in parenting, and so it's not only issues that. So it's a dual purpose that I'm sharing it. One is because as parents, we need discipline to be able to discipline our children, okay? But our children need to learn the skills of discipline in order to survive in this society that's going to be so complex and have so much. I mean, it's like exponentially it's going out there in terms of the choices and options that they're going to have. Especially if they're going to either parallel or live within a culture that's going to, you know, unless we can turn that in some way, and I don't know. But anyway, let me share with you concept of discipline. Discipline, according to Scott Peck, is a system of techniques for dealing constructively with the pain of problem solving instead of avoiding that pain. Okay, so here we have a set of issues. There's something that I want, okay? And discipline would be going through and thinking through and using techniques to get at, go through the pain of problem solving without going around it. So that if I'm in conflict with my parents, discipline would tell me to use certain techniques to go directly to my parents instead of to deal with this problem that I have with my parents as opposed to going around them. And he says that there's four basic techniques. And so it's a system of techniques. And he says that these four comprise that system of techniques. One is delaying gratification. And I think that that's at the root, in my mind, of the consumer society, is we're told, have it now, have it now, have it now, have it now. You need this now. It's important you have it now. Everyone else on your block has it. You need it now if you don't have it. We hear that. We get bombarded with that. And that sense of delaying gratification is an important skill and discipline to be able to withstand the battering that our advertising world does to us. An assumption of responsibility. And that has to do with effectively knowing and perceiving when we're responsible for something and when we're not responsible. And Scott Peck talks about it in the context of he uses two extremes of not assuming proper responsibility. The one is the person who is never responsible for his behavior, and he calls that a conduct disorder kid. And that's a kid who basically, everything that happens to him is someone else's fault. There's always a reason why I didn't get my homework done. There's always a reason why I punched that kid out. It was the other kid's fault, it wasn't mine. Or it was my dad's fault because my dad hit me. It's a constant projection of blame to other people. So that's on the one side. The other side is he calls the neurotic. And that's where everything's my fault. And I'm paralyzed and I can't do anything because it's, you know, if something goes wrong, it's automatically my fault. And so he sees that we have to be able to be, we have to be discerning to understand and of when that assumption of responsibility, when we need to be responsible. We need to be responsible for our behavior. If we act in a certain way, we have to own it and we have to be responsible for it. If someone else acts in a certain way, we don't have to be responsible for it. And that's where the neurotic gets in. If you were to act out and I had just been in relationship with you, somehow your acting out would be my fault. So learning that kind of discretion. Thirdly, a dedication to truth or reality. Basic honesty. Being willing to not be fooled by our desires of wanting something to be a certain way when it's not. To calling if someone behaves criminally, of being willing to say that's wrong and not trying to find euphemisms for it. Not looking for excuses essentially for our behavior, which is, those two in a sense are related, not accepting responsibility. One of the ways we don't accept responsibility is by twisting reality, by saying we really didn't mean that or that's not really what we did. And then finally, a sense is a balancing. And that balancing is also part of what that whole sense of the consumer society doesn't want us to be balanced, because if we're balanced, I believe that we will not respond to the advertising. That you have to be slightly unbalanced in order for their advertising to be effective. And I guess I mean that somewhat in a mental health term as well. That there's strong, I believe in my field, there's strong resistance in the core of our culture to us being a healthy culture. Because if we're healthy, discerning people, we're not going to buy the things that we buy. We're not going to be tricked and fooled by advertising. So there's billions of dollars invested, as I look at it, in us continuing the consumer cycle and therefore not being whole, discerning, healthy people. I don't know if any of you, every once in a while I'll watch a television show. We don't watch a lot of commercial television just because it drives me crazy. But when we do watch it, I really pay attention to the commercials in terms of trying to figure out what is it? What do they expect? What level do they expect me to be? How? What do I have to be in order to buy their message? In order to believe what they're saying? And it's scary to think in terms of how you really have to believe in the system, and that the system is there for your benefit, and that everyone, you know, that this thing is really gonna help you to be a better person. Because that's what they're trying to tell us, that smoking is pleasurable, you know, and selling us on that. That drinking beer will make you sexy and have all of these friends. It's lies.
The university had somebody come in who brought commercials with them and then stopped framing it for us. So we had to look at every frame and say, what are they doing each time? It was a McDonald's ad. We were not looking at the hamburger. We were looking at the grandmother. It is impossible for you to look at that frame without looking at the grandmother. You felt good about the grandmother, and then they took that away and put the McDonald's thing. Grandmother, McDonald's. Grandmother, McDonald's. And then walk away. You didn't have to look at the hamburger at all.
And it works.
No choice. Once you committed yourself to watch it, he showed us how you had no choice after that. You followed where they put you.
Yes.
It's a powerful technique. Powerful technique.
And it isn't just at the surface.
No, we have to teach our children. That was the goal of my class on TV, is you have to teach children media literacy. Mm-hmm. We have to teach them to do that. Well, an additional thing that Scott Peck says that I think is real powerful is that the strength, energy, and willingness to use these techniques are provided by love. The strength, energy, and willingness to use these techniques are provided by love. Now, for Scott Peck, love is not some wishy-washy feeling. Love, he defines, as an action. It's an action verb, and it's acting towards the sole purpose of nurturing our own spiritual growth or the spiritual growth of other people. So it's a behavior, and it's not feeling. And he spends a lot of time talking about the falling in love and those kinds of things as not being love. But it can lead to love. But we go into it. We don't make a good, you know, we're using the same word, and so therefore it's confusing in our culture. But he sees then that love, and I think that discipline, where, and it's ultimately the goal of parenting as I see it, is to provide our children discipline with love. And if we define love as working towards their nurturing their spiritual growth, that's a worthy goal for us to reach. I think there are a lot of tricks that get played on us within our culture, and I think it's hard work for us to pay attention to those tricks, to bring them to light, and to help our children learn the skills of dealing with those tricks. That our children are going to need more than ever that sense of discipline, and that they're going to be faced even more than we are, because I don't think we have done as well at turning around the consumption of our planet as we've struggled. Okay, I think our children, at least the ones coming up who are already born in their lifetimes, they're going to have a harder task ahead. They're going to be because of some of our failures. And so I think part of what we can give them is we can give them optimism and a sense of strength through their health. And I think that that's a goal that is counter to consumerism and is worthy of us paying attention to. There's also something about the human spirit that leaves me optimistic about this, a resilience. And I believe it to be the Spirit of God in all of us. It's kind of, you and I had a little discussion there in terms of where that comes from, but I believe it's part of the image that's planted within us. And that there are ways that people disconnect or overcome the power of our consumer world in ways that are real surprising to us. I'd like to share with you a song that I discovered. It was written a while ago and actually was part of, it was a song that was written based on a portion of Grapes of Wrath, the book. I discovered that because I shared this with my family and my son had just read the Grapes of Wrath and he says, I know that story. And so he went back and he reread it and it's very similar to this. But this is called, this is a song by Kris Kristofferson. Okay, you may know him as an actor and a singer. Here comes that rainbow again. The scene was a small roadside cafe. The waitress was sweet. Oh, I gotta stop. You gotta picture me playing the guitar and singing it in kind of a. I should learn it. I haven't learned it yet on the guitar, but I will. But a twangy Western, you know, a true Western or true country style, not a country Western style, a true country style. The scene was a small roadside cafe. The waitress was sweeping the floor. Two truck drivers drinking their coffee, and two oaky kids by the door. How much are them candies? They asked her. How much have you got? She replied. We've only a penny between us. They're two for a penny, she lied. The daylight grew heavy with thunder, with the smell of the rain on the wind. Ain't it just like a human? Here comes that rainbow again. One truck driver called to the waitress after the kids went outside. Them candies ain't two for a penny. So what's it to you? She replied. In silence, they finished their coffee. They got up and nodded goodbye. She called, hey, you left too much money. So what's it to you, they replied. The daylight grew heavy with thunder. With the smell of the rain on the wind, ain't it just like a human? Here comes that rainbow again.
Even without the guitars.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you. I'm inspired by this. I think we haven't solved it by any means, but I think the solutions lie within each of us, and I think it takes great effort, and it's as we spread to our separate ways, I think I wish you Godspeed and God's Spirit as you struggle with this, because it's not going to go away. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.